We are now recording.
Good afternoon. I'd like to call the September 20th, 2021 Legislation and Rules Committee meeting to order. Can I have a roll call, please?
Leroy Brady.
Here.
Michael Fondren.
Here.
Robert Stanley.
Here.
Sir.
Edward Marley.
Here.
Peter Leeds.
Here.
Dr. Alejandro Angel.
Here.
Doug Bartlett.
Here.
We have a quorum.
Thank you. Looks like we might have some guests on the line as well. Can we just have them announce who they are and what agenda item they want to speak to, since I don't have a sign-in sheet. That's all right.
Yeah, I want to go down just the people list that I have here. Let's see, Joel Worth.
That's me, I'm here. I can't see the agenda item, but I'm here to talk about the ADEQ question.
Okay. Very good. Welcome.
Thank you.
Yeah, hello. My name is John Rezebeck. I'm here. I'm also here to talk about the ADEQ questions.
Okay. Then I have David Monahan. And Suzanne.
Yes, David Monahan here to listen to the ADEQ portion of the meeting. Thank you.
Suzanne Ehrlich. I'm here for the ADEQ matter also.
And then later on, I do have a Ben Chrysler, and he would like to be called when we get to agenda item 5C.
Okay.
And it looks like Heidi Wellhorn has called in. I believe she's for the ADEQ question. But Heidi, if you would like to chime in and let us know why you're here real quick.
Yeah. Hi. I am a subcontractor with ADEQ. I'm working with John Rezebeck, and we had submitted some questions to the State Board of Technical Registration.
Okay. And I think that's all I have, Ed. If other
okay.
people come in, they may. I did send out a lot of information to those who are interested in the ADEQ agenda item. Some others might pop in.
Great, thank you.
And this is Janie Ray. I'm your legal advisor for today, taking Scott Donald's place.
Oh, very good. Welcome. Hi. And welcome, everyone. Call to the public. Members of the public may address the committee during this call to the public for no more than 3 minutes. Pursuant to ARS 38431.01H, the committee members are not allowed to discuss or take legal action on matters raised during an open call to the public unless the matters are properly noticed for discussion and action. However, members may ask staff to review a matter that may be placed on a future agenda. If you're here and you just want to address this committee, not specifically for any agendized item, this is your time. Is there anyone who wishes to do so?
No one contacted me in order to speak in this
session. Okay. Great. Hearing none. Adoption of minutes. Review, consideration, and action on the following. Approve, modify, or reject the November 10th, 2020 L&R committee minutes. Do I have a motion?
So moved. Seconded. Peter Leeds. Mike Fondren.
Mike Fondren made the motion. Any discussion? Hearing no discussion, all those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. Thank you. All right. why everyone is here today. Agenda item 5A, ADEQ's questions submitted to the board and public comment regarding the questions and discussions and possibly draft a substantive policy statement, rule change, or statutory change for recommendation to the board. If everyone has copies or can see it on the screen, I am not going to read that verbatim. but what I'd like to do is maybe have some of my civil engineering colleagues on this committee chime in first to start the conversation off, and then we'll allow the public to weigh in as well. Dr. Angel, would it be possible to get a just a summary of what the issues are so that we can get the conversation started?
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Yeah, so I'll share what I think I understand, and just this also came up to the full board a couple of meetings ago. So the board thought it would be a good idea to send it to LNR first to review. What happens is ADEQ is in the process of drafting new rules, and as they've been going through that process, they've identified some statutes or rules from our board that they're not clear on. So that's what their questions are based on. And really, what I understand to be the issue is, you know, what type of septic work requires a registrant engineer and what doesn't. And there's a lot of interest from both sides or from everywhere. Because there, you know, there's issues of public protection on the one hand, and there's issues of, you know, business and availability of workforce on the other hand. So that's a big picture summary of my understanding. I don't know if anybody else has something to add.
I think you summarized it quite well. Kirk, how would you like to proceed with our input from our public members of the public that are here?
I personally think that Mr. Rezavec maybe should introduce himself, and he's part of ADEQ, and he's the one who initially gave me the questions, and maybe he
okay.
can also take it.
I think that's a great question, Mr. Elizabeth, if you could state your name for the record, and then give us a summary of ADEQ's position here.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. My name is John Rezebeck. I work for the groundwater protection section of ADEQ's water quality division. LNR committee member Angel, I believe you did introduce the subject astutely. We are in the middle of a rulemaking process, and designing an on-site wastewater treatment facility, whether that's an engineering practice or not, is kind of a threshold issue as to how we craft our rules. You know, whether we require a registrant to submit documentation or not. So that's kind of this foundational threshold issue that we're looking for clarification so that we can make sure that our rules are clear and align as best as possible with the ASPGR's statute and rule and interpretation. The rest of the rules kind of follow suit in a way. I mean, they're all kind of clarification issues that really have roots in that original question. I think I'll just stop there in the interest of not going on and on about specifics and questions 2, 3, and 4 on the screen.
Okay. just rereading some of this text. So basically, to risk very crudely summarizing the questions, it seems that it's a matter of at what's the cutoff, what should be the cutoff point for the requirement for registration versus an exemption. So I'd like to ask the members of the public that are present. Kurt, I'm going to let you pick from the list as you go along, and or I can have them raise their hand. I don't know. Do you have a raise hand feature on this one?
Yes, there should be a feature under chat. Let's see. I know a number of people said they just want to listen in, so I was going to start with Heidi. I think she may have wanted to say something.
Okay.
Oh.
Could you state your name for the record, please, and then you can proceed?
I'm Heidi Wellborn, subcontracting for ADEQ. I really don't have too much more to add to what John Rezavec already said, since we're working very closely on this and drafted these questions together. The only thing I would add is that it would just help clarify how we establish qualifications for people, regardless of whether they are an engineer or not, so it would give us a starting point to on our understanding, as well as knowing when we should or shouldn't ask for engineer documentation.
Okay. Anyone else from the public wish to address the board or the committee? Sorry. Okay, Joelle Wirth.
Okay, this is Joelle Wirth. I did submit comments to the committee, and I think I went through the whole four questions. As I look at it, so I am a past regulator, but I'm currently a consultant and a wastewater designer. I feel like our current ADEQ rules are very defined. They have some obvious trigger marks, and they are in the rules, and that's the 3,000 gallons per day. We're in the 4.23 general permit, where it actually calls out that you have to have engineering plans. And then, in addition, there's many places or many counties that just by rule have it required that you have a registrant seal plans if it's a commercial property. And I feel like those are very reasonable. I think what has happened is when we put a line in the sand that's in a dollar sign, you know, what we've all experienced this last year is problems with the supply chain. And now we've had lumber going up triple what it normally is. So when we've had this $12,500 mark that we've been using to determine when you need it to be a registrant or a non-registrant, that just hasn't kept up with inflation. That's been on the books for, I think, at least 30 years that I can recall, without any modification or any adjustment. So putting a number and rule, I think, is kind of an outdated way of doing stuff because we can't keep up with modern times. And I also think if you look at how the food service industry does it, they switch from a regulatory-based going to risk assessment. And that's sort of how I see it in our rules with that 4.23. But the more you do, the more you have to do. And then the logical sequence is that if you have larger flows, it makes sense to have the registrant seal on the plans. It makes sense to have the ongoing operation and maintenance and oversight. And I think that's the better way to go than to just call out if it's a $10,000 modification to a $100,000 wastewater treatment plan. I think those are some of the things that I wrote to you guys in my concerns addressing these questions. And I clearly think the big difference between a wastewater treatment plant compared to an on-site system for a single-family residence or even some smaller facilities, and where the industry is going, is not everything can go to a wastewater treatment plant. And we're seeing now opportunities for more distributed systems that are step and stag systems. And I don't think that all of those lend themselves necessarily to all the engineers.
Yeah.
That's my point. So thanks.
Thank you.
That was actually me, yeah. Because I don't have Facebook. Yeah.
Anyone else wish to address the committee? Very quiet group for a Monday. All right, well, let's, committee, let's begin discussion and see where we're going to go from here. Dr. Angel, I'm going to rely on you quite a bit today since you are our civil engineer representative.
I'm happy to chime in. I see Mr. Leeds has his hand up, but he can, go first.
I'm sorry. Go ahead, Mr. Leeds.
Thank you, Doctor. The it seems to me the difference that we're talking about here is would be the difference between a facility and a plant. I don't see in the rules that they designate the difference between a facility and a plant, but all of the input that we're getting in the paperwork on this for this committee has simply been trying to designate the difference between an on-water facility and a waste management plant. 3,000 gallons per day seems to be everyone's cutoff. Personally, I feel that on residences of single-family, and I think that a single-family, since there's been a question about that, should also include the guest houses and the garages and any other building on a single-family dwelling. If it's less than 3,000 gallons per day, could be defined as a on-site waste facility and not be regulated with the requirement of engineering and other, and as an opinion.
Thank you. Dr. Angel.
Mr. Chair, so I'll start with the first question and then after that maybe start backwards on my thoughts. The first question is whether some of these on-site systems are an engineering practice or not. I don't think we should be asking necessarily whether they're water treatment plants or not. The question is this engineering practice or not? And that's actually, I think, the way ADEQ phrased it. And then engineering practice, the way it reads now with the new definition on, in statute that passed earlier this year is, are all those activities that require engineering principles and interpreting engineering data that clearly impact the health, safety, and welfare of the public. So this goes back to public health and safety. And so I think whether it's a wastewater treatment plant, whether it's a water line, whether it's a landfill, whether it's anything that's engineering, if it affects the public, it's engineering practice. If it doesn't, it's not, based on our latest definition. And so I think we need to look at it from that lens, because then it goes on to the next. And let me back up. So I don't think the question was asked, can we provide a substantial policy statement saying whether this is or isn't engineering practice? And I think there's so many variations of this that it would be hard for us to say whether it is or isn't engineering practice a specific case. But that part I don't think we can answer. The question is, if somebody reviewing things thinks that it has the potential to affect the public, then it's engineering practice. If it doesn't, it isn't. That's, and they need to rely on that, and then if there's an issue, it would be decided on the merits of that case. So that's sort of the general picture. Going back, I think what's important to note and is that anything that's a single-family residential is exempt. And I, there was a question as to whether, you know, this is really exempt given that it's not part of the structure. And in my mind, it clearly is, because you can't build a house without, you know, this connection, and anything from the water meter to the house is also part of the house, and you know, all those attachments are part of the house. So I think if you're doing a septic system, in my opinion, for a single family home, it doesn't matter if it's, you know, 3,000 gallons, 5,000, 10 gallons, I don't care. It's exempt if it's for a single family home. And that's also consistent with statute, because you're, if it's a single family home, you're not impacting the public. You're impacting your own family and yourself, right? I think right. Where it gets complicated is if it's an apartment complex or a restaurant or something like that, and it has an on-site treatment that could affect the public. So that's not part of the exemption, but I think single family is exempt.
when I...
And regardless of flows, regardless of costs, regardless of anything, even if it's over $100,000, but it's for a single-family home, that exemption does not have a dollar limit or a flow limit. If you are not a single-family home and you fall somewhere else, then you are subject to the dollar limits that the statute has. I couldn't agree more with the fact that I don't like the dollar limits from 30 years ago. The challenge is, I think we need to interpret the statutes and the rules as they are now. It's not how we want the rules and statutes. That can be a future discussion.
Yes.
But the discussion today is, how do we interpret the statutes that we have? And those statutes have that 12,500 limit, which, again, as I read the statute, in my mind, it's clear that it's $12,500 additions to the system, not, you know. So that's sort of my thing. And the other reason why it's hard, I think, to specify 3,000 gallons or any number is because then we would have to do that for everything that you do with engineering. You know, it'd be the same for water flows, it'd be the same for structural elements, it'd be the same for, you know, drainage, it would be the same for everything. So that's why I think, even though flawed, that's why the statute calls out a monetary number to say that it's de minimis, basically. So those are my thoughts on the issue.
Thank you, Dr. Angel. Mr. Rosenbeck, I believe you had your hand up first.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Marley. I just wanted to, I generally agreed with Mr. Angel's statement. There's one part of it I wanted to take issue with, and that was the fact that you stated that, you know, the single family exemption, you know, that's only going to affect that family and that property. You know, on-site wastewater treatment facilities are installed all over Arizona, and, you know, in the aggregate, especially if they're not installed with you know, the expertise of an engineer, there really could be a significant effect to the vadose zone and to the aquifer. So I just wanted to point that out. I don't think it's quite that simple. Thank you.
Thank you.
And I think you're absolutely right, Mr. Rezabek. I misspoke when I said that. I think it's a less direct connection. And then again, the point is, regardless of what we individually think, the statute says if it is anything that's part of a single family structure is exempt from statute from requiring an engineering. So that's why even if you are doing, you know, a single family house with a complicated structure, you don't need an engineer to do it. It's exempt.
Thank you. And I think and maybe our assistant attorney general representative can correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe the residential exemption extends to three or less units, not just single family.
I
saw hands up and then they went away. So.
Okay. So.
I think that was me.
Mr.
My
Stanley.
System keeps on turning everything off and back on again for me.
Oh,
I was just I think the single, we've used the example of structures a few times for single family dwellings, but I think if you go dig into it a little bit farther, it's you have to be conform to some code, some certain aspects of it for it to rely on single family. For structural to be exempt. For instance, if you're going to do a 60-foot span and a bunch of other things, I don't think that falls into the exemption part. It's been a while since I've looked at that part of the code, but I have to look at it more, the building code itself, even though and then they say you need to get the sale. I was wondering if ADEQ would give us, if they're concerned, you know, they brought up some good concerns, what kind of limit would they be thinking about in their mind, because they're the experts on this type of stuff, and they're the ones who see the problems that come up, you know, later, and they have to maybe try to help people fix them. That's all.
Ed?
Yes.
Sorry, I think Bob, your point was spot on, which is, you know, the Board of Technical Registration exempts single family regardless of how complicated the structure is. And the board only establishes minimum requirements. And so your building codes can demand other things, and the local agencies can demand additional things of your structure to make sure it's sound. I think it could be something similar here, where the board is saying any residential is exempt from this from the board's perspective. If ADEQ believes that they need to set a threshold for size or cost or some other flow, anything, that's ADEQ's purview, not the board's.
No, very good point.
Joelle Worth, your hand is up.
I just had a quick comment to make, maybe for Mr. Rezabek, but I've been in the industry for 30 years, and I am not aware of substantial outbreaks or problems that we have had with the current process that has allowed registrants and non-registrants to do designs. And this has been the kind of the underlying theme, that we just don't have a whole lot of dead bodies, as ADEQ has been asking to see. And so I just think it's important to recognize this. And we also have in the industry, and over a partnership with ADEQ through the delegated agencies, that also recognize registered people that are not registered professional engineers, registered sanitarians, registered geologists. Many of these folks are doing this work right now and designing, and I am just not aware of these grave concerns that are being brought forth by the agency. So I'd like to hear if they have some to share.
Ms. Wellborn, you have your hand up.
Can you state your name
for the record, please?
Yeah. I'm Heidi Wellborn. I'm legal specialist subcontracting with ADEQ, working with John Rezabek. All of a sudden, cannot see you at all. Okay. Sorry. I just wanted to touch base on something that Joelle just raised, because I've kind of been thinking that I needed to address it. I just want to make sure that it's understood. We're not necessarily pushing to say you need to be an engineer to design on-site wastewater treatment facility or not. I think for sure we wanted to make it clear that certainly from ADEQ's perspective, an on-site wastewater treatment facility does have an impact to drinking water, to groundwater. I mean, that is why on-site wastewater treatment facilities are regulated. But properly installed and everything, right? I mean, they are fine, right? They're helpful for people to be able to dispose of their wastewater. But in the aggregate, if they're not maintained, if they're improperly installed, etc., they could have an impact on the environment, which is the whole point of why they're regulated under ADEQ's authority. So I just wanted to clarify that point, that even if it is part of a detached single-family dwelling in the eyes of ASBTR, for ADEQ, it's still important to regulate and establish requirements for qualifications of people that are installing facilities and for the facilities themselves. So I just wanted to clarify that ADEQ is not necessarily pushing for one way or the other, except for clarity, so that ADEQ knows, you know, whether its rules are in alignment with where they should be and what requirements ADEQ needs to put into place to make sure that these facilities are installed appropriately, etc.
Thank you. Anyone else? Hearing none, I think time for some more discussion amongst the committee members. think.
Mr. Chair, so
yes.
Just a quick distinction. So I think, just to be absolutely clear, I think from the board's perspective, at least for me, because the whole board hasn't weighed in, the Board of Technical Registration has no jurisdiction over single-family homes in terms of requiring an engineer.
Right.
Because of the exemption. That's a legislative function, not a board function. Likewise, the Board of Technical Registration has no jurisdiction over additions, changes, or modifications under $12,500. That's also been decided by the legislature. When something doesn't fall under those two exemptions, the case has to be weighed on its merits. So, you know, a septic system right next to a drinking water source could be different than something else. So the answer for everything else is it depends, and it really depends on the case. But in those two instances, the board has no requirements, and if there's a desire or a need to have requirements for those two cases, it would be up to ADEQ to decide what those are and regulate and enforce them. At least that's how I see it.
That's right.
I would agree.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any clarifying language we need to adopt through a substantive policy statement or clarifying any of our statutes or rules that would help make this a little clearer for folks? Obviously, it's there's some concerns, and I just want to make sure that we get those addressed.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman, this is Peter Leeds. We're still dealing with number one, A1, right? You haven't moved down? Because I do have some statements on 2, 3, and 4, but on 8, or have you taken the whole A in comprehensively?
I think we've kind of been discussing the whole A comprehensively because we've touched on, like, we've touched on 3 some. We've even touched on 2. And
yeah,
we're kind of doing it holistically.
Yes, well, then there's a couple of things I do want to put in there. The industry seems to be concerned with the availability of designers and installers, and that if we allow ADEQ to go out and tell and say that all the designers have to be engineers, I think that it's been well documented that there would be an uprising in the industry. Well, I think the board should clarify a little bit more than just saying that that the single family units are exempt and anything under $12,500 is exempt. I think we might need to get more involved in setting a better standard, even if it is a flow design. Now, I know that the doctor doesn't really want to get into flow design, but I think flow design really might be the answer to this problem that ADEQ is facing right now. DRL.
Dr. Angel, do you want to respond?
Mr. Leeds is one of the smartest guys I know, so I respect his opinion. I just don't think, if we start getting into specific numbers here, it's like we're taking legislation into our own hands, and I think that has to go through the rulemaking process, and that's what ADEQ is doing. So I think that's where it belongs. We've told ADEQ and everybody else, single families, which represent, I think this came up at the board meeting, so someone correct me, please, if I'm wrong, but single families represent 90% of the on-site water treatment. And we're saying those don't require a civil engineering registrant. So that should reduce the concern there, at least from the board's perspective. I think it's on ADEQ if they believe that some of those require registrants to make the case and why that's necessary so that it can get put onto the rulemaking process.
Yes. That would be the right way to go.
So one of the issues I see in our current statutes is this $12,000 limitation, and I think that it's not a reasonable number in this economy. But I guess I question, is there a better way to, and Dr. Angel, you brought this up, is there a better way to address some kind of scope limitation for a non-registrant without assigning a dollar value to it? Because I don't even, I wouldn't even know where to start trying to guess where that dollar number should be. I don't know how that was determined back however many years ago, and I, you know, obviously it hasn't kept up with inflation, and it definitely hasn't kept up with today's inflation market.
And if you were to put the wrong filter or the wrong treatment, you know, even if it's $500, you can screw up the whole $100,000 system or $1 million system.
Right.
So, I mean, the dollar amount is flawed. It's the statute we have. I mean, by the way, this is not even something that would go through rulemaking. This would need to go through our, you know, House and Senate to change the number.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it has to go to the legislature.
Yes, it would. They did. They did actually, in the paperwork, I noticed somebody calculated the inflation cost up to $36,000.
I saw that as well.
But I agree with Dr. Angel that the legislature would have to make the change on the $12,500. That's not in rules.
Right. So I think from that aspect of it, I think the industry needs to, if they want to see that change, they need to approach a legislator and lobby them to make that change. It's not something that we have any authority to do at this point.
And Mr. Chairman, this is Peter once again.
Yes.
On A3, we really haven't so much addressed how a cost of a repair or a modification to a waste treatment plant would affect the waste treatment plant if that modification is less than $12,500. There was in the paperwork, one of the engineers actually was saying that he does believe that anyone who touches a waste treatment plant, say that $100,000 plant, should be an engineer. I am a little concerned that we do include waste on-site waste treatment, wastewater treatment facilities in the same category as a waste treatment plant, especially when it comes to the repairs, because I do agree with Dr. Angel that the wrong filter, the wrong additive, anything into those systems could screw up an entire system. So I think maybe we need to get some opinions from the people that have come to join us on item number 3 and see what they have to say about that. A3. Peter out.
Anyone in the industry wish to chime in? Give us some input?
Mr. Chair, going back to Mr. Lee's comment, I think if there is a substantial or substantive policy statement to be had here, it would be on that item number 3. Because I think, again, the number one as to what's engineering and what isn't, that's a case by case, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I think number 4, as I mentioned, sort of is clear to me, and I guess I don't know if others, but to me, single-family homes are exempt, clearly. So the question here is, how does the board interpret the $12,500 limit? Is it interpreted as the modification or the total cost of the system, as ADQ asked? I tend to think, or read it, because when I read it, it says, a non-registrant who designs a wastewater treatment plant or extensions, additions, or modifications, if the cost of such construction, and it's such construction, so the modifications, does not exceed $12,500.
Right.
So I think it's $12,500 in mods, but I can see how that can be confusing.
Ms. Ehrlich.
So that's an item that is of considerable interest to the regulators. As has been said, you make, if a non-registrant is designing modifications to a community treatment facility that is handling the waste for a small community, it's not a big municipal plant. We're talking, you know, maybe it's 30,000 gallons per day. Non-registrant goes and does a modification or an addition to the system. The whole system costs more than the five, and the repair only costs 10,000. It doesn't, that can be disastrous. You could put, you know, a large number of households, relatively speaking, discharging to a treatment facility that's not being maintained and repaired correctly. And so I would like to see a substantive policy statement that indicated that it was, if the value of the whole facility or the design of the whole facility was over 12.5, then any changes to that facility would need to be managed by a registrant.
Ms. Rillich, so our problem is we can't decide how to interpret the statutes. You know, I agree with you with what you're saying, but the way I read the statute as written is the modification. So once again, if ADEQ identifies, and all it does is exempt that specific situation from requiring a PE under our statute, ADEQ can require a PE or some other qualification, whether it's a different qualification. It doesn't have to be a PE. It can be a certain number of training hours or certifications to do that work separately. But I think we need to understand, or a substantive policy would need to discuss how the board interprets what the legislators wrote, not how we would like to interpret it.
And so would your legal counsel agree that this language refers only to the modification and not to the total cost of the plant?
You know, I'm not really able to give an opinion to anybody but the board in executive session, so.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
Mr. Morley, this is Judith. If I could just add a thought to what you're saying,
yes.
What Dr. Angel's saying, I mean, to me, and also what Mr. Leeds had said, the difference between a plant and a facility, I don't want to split hairs, but I had a difficult time. There isn't really anything clear in our definition. I'm just wondering if, well, a substantive policy statement, you know, that's only as good as the board that's in place at the moment. I don't think that that's really a really good solution to the questions at hand. I'm wondering if potentially if we had a clear definition of plant or facility, if that might be something useful to consider.
Okay. I understand. Ms. Wellborn.
I don't think changing the dollar amount ultimately in statute, even if we could do that, or, you know, it could be done in a legislative change, I don't see that being a good long-term solution either, because then at some point you're going to be in the same place you are right now, saying, oh, that was put into place, you know, 30 years ago.
Right.
Maybe going with that, the view of, and again, I'm just assuming there could be a legislative change, but more of the risk assessment approach as was suggested rather than just the dollar amount. So just some thoughts I'm putting out there to see if it spurs anybody else's thoughts on that.
And so with regards, this is Heidi Wellborn again.
Yes.
With regards to the dollar amount, it doesn't really matter. I mean, if most facilities that are being built or the modifications cost more than $12,500 because it's such an outdated number, then it doesn't really matter if single-family dwellings if on-site facilities are included in the detached single-family dwelling exemption, because probably, I think, probably like 80% of on-site facilities are single family dwellings. So that would probably, would knock out most of them. And I guess I'm just wondering. So if ADAQ can require a PE regardless of whether ASBTR considers it engineering practice, whether or not it's exempted, then what value does that? I mean, it brings the educational value, but the certification itself, the PE certification, or their sign off or signature. I mean, it's not really backed up by the board certification at that point, is it? I guess I'm confused as to what weight that carries for the public, besides the obvious, education. But there wouldn't be the board backup on that. So that's two things, I guess. The other thing I guess I would wonder is whether rules would be appropriate, since this has been an issue that's been brought up since at least 2001, 2005. I guess I wonder if it would be helpful for the general public to have something on the books so that ADEQ or other agencies that deal with these questions may be able to reference them. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I can weigh in on the question about, if the BTR doesn't require a PE, but ADEQ decided to require a PE, what does that mean? And there's a lot of local agencies require PEs for things that the board doesn't require. So that wouldn't be the first time. And when a PE stamps a document, they're still responsible for its content and for making sure that it's correct. So there are, whether the board requires a PE to do a certain thing or not, if a professional stamps the document, they need to meet the professional standard of care. So it would have that meaning. It doesn't mean that it's not backed up by the board. It means, it exceeds the minimum that we require as a board. But it also gives ADEQ or any other agency the opportunity to use something that's not a PE. Maybe there's people who have specific training on on-site treatment systems that know as much or more than PEs on a specific item.
I agree.
Joelle Wirth, it looks like you had your hand up.
I'm okay. I took my hand down. Thank you.
Oh, okay.
Mr. Chairman, just a couple of comments on Heidi Wellborn's statement. I believe that the single-family residence and the $12,500 are standalone issues. I don't believe that if you could, if the water treatment plant, or facility rather, on-site is going to cost more than $12,500 on a single-family unit, that it does not meet the exemption. So I believe it does meet the exemption. And therefore, those are two standalone rules. They're not brought together. Peter out.
Thank you, Peter. Other comments?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I don't believe that the committee needs to make any take any action on this question. I think that Dr. Angel is right that ADEQ could do whatever they want with their organization, and that the board has specified sufficiently who requires a PE as far as the board is concerned. I believe that the ball is going to actually be in ADQ's own court right now.
Thank you, Mr. Leeds. Ms. Ehrlich?
On question number two, does it make any difference to this conversation if the definition of an on-site wastewater treatment facility is different from an on-site wastewater, or a wastewater treatment plant? Are they synonymous as far as the board is concerned?
I'll speak again for myself only, because we would only be able to answer a case on the specific merits, Ms. Ulrich, but on the way of guidance, that exception talks about a non-registered who designs a water or wastewater treatment plant, extensions, blah, 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 or extensions to water distribution or collection systems. So it's not just wastewater treatment plants, it's water distribution or collection systems. And I would think that the on-site water treatment is certainly a collection system. So my general reading of that is that it still falls under that exemption, anything that either collects or conveys water.
Peter here. So without the wastewater treatment on-site collection, a definition of wastewater treatment facility different than a wastewater treatment plant would be very helpful. However, as the doctor just pointed out, it's not refined to just wastewater. So trying to change the definitions of those two would be difficult. But on the other hand, as far as the board rules go, it's treating both of those as a wastewater treatment plant and giving what we call a facility an exemption, two exemptions actually, for single family and for less than $12,500, which pulls the wastewater treatment, what we call a facility, out of the plant category in the exemptions itself. So I don't see any need to change.
And by the way, this part is me just completely conjecturing, but I'm guessing that when that exemption came up into statute, it was specifically thinking of sewer or of septic systems. I doubt anybody had in mind an actual, you know, municipal wastewater treatment plant under $12,000.
Yeah, I would agree. So is the tone of this committee that we're going to take no action and communicate that back to the board?
Yes. I agree with that.
As do I.
I do.
I'll yield to the engineers and agree.
I will yield to the engineers as well and agree.
Mr. Chairman, I'd just like to ask, I agree, but wanted to ask ADEQ if there was something else that they wanted to get out of this conversation that they haven't heard, or...
No, I mean, I think we're hoping for just clarity on your end as to what these statutes meant to the board. And it would be more helpful, honestly, to have that in writing or some rule form. I guess I'll just leave it at that. John, do you have anything else? I know you have to go soon.
I don't think I have anything else. I guess I'll just add that we do have a lot of people from the regulated community that cite these statutes kind of against what might be in rule. So there is a lot of back and forth about which authority is to be followed. We were hoping to get a little bit more clarity on some of the ambiguities in these statutes. But I also understand that this is a statute, for it to be changed, it needs to go through the legislative process, and it's not appropriate for the L&R committee to legislate here in this meeting. I do understand that. So I guess I'll just leave it there, and thank you all for your time.
Yeah, I mean,
some clarification would be, we kept on using the single family exemption, and then we go to structural and talk about the exemption. Well, the code, you know, so the state board says single family is exempt. You go to the code, and the code says single family is exempt. However, you have to follow these rules, and if you don't follow these rules, then you got to get an engineer. So I think that's, you know, that's the difference with your are. You guys are on the code side, not so much the BTR side. And you can come back and say, if you got more than 3,000 gallons per household, then you need an engineer. That's entirely what you should be looking at.
Yeah.
Whatever you think is appropriate. Kurt, is this meeting being recorded in case anybody or ADQ or someone wants to refer to the conversation later? Is this recorded?
It most certainly is.
Good. Good, so.
Any other comments? Otherwise, we'll close this issue. I don't think there's any vote needed since we're not taking any action. I want to thank everyone who attended regarding this item, and thank you, and we will move on to the next agenda item.
Thank you all for your time.
Yeah. Thank you.
Mr. Marley, this is Kurt Winter. We do have Mr. Denlin here who has submitted the Substantive Policy 1 language. He is here physically, and he would like to speak before you.
Okay.
Hi. Thank you, Chairman, Director, Staff, Committee, for giving me a few minutes here. I'll try not to take a whole lot of time. But I've been practicing in this area for about 43 years in the Phoenix area in particular. And I was around in 1995 when this policy statement was first brought up. And the practice back then was jurisdictions didn't even hire registrants to review plans by registrants. And they would oftentimes mark up as quote-unquote minor changes and issue the permits approved as noted. And that created a problem not only the fact that these were comments not created by a bona fide employee of the registrant, which violates state law, but oftentimes it might have infringed on the registrant's interpretation of the code at that point. The way the policy was originally written in 95, the jurisdictions got around it by saying, oh, here, we're no longer going to mark up the plans. We're just going to give you a letter and say this is what you've got to get to get your permit. Where we run into the problem is anything under compulsion and mandatory still the same thing as forcing me as a registrant to accept someone else's professional judgment over mine? We see that right now. I've seen it in countless times. I'm not the only one. I've had one plan reviewer tell me that the definition of a retained wall starts from the top of footing to the top of the wall, no matter how much is being retained, even though the engineering books that I submitted documents from showed that he was wrong, and this was a non-registrant. And we run into problems where my judgment, professional judgment, is constantly being usurped by either another registrant or, more importantly, a non-registrant, neither of which has the liability that I carry once I seal the drawings, telling me this is your judgment now because I'm not giving you your permit for it. I have a problem with that. And so the question comes when I first start looking at the policy, and I've sat on the EAC for a lot of years, so I've had this come back many times as I've reviewed cases. The question is, what constitutes judgment? I don't disagree that a building official has the authority to quote-unquote interpret the code. However, that line has to be drawn where that interpretation exceeds my judgment. And so what I've done, and I don't know, Kurt, did you give this to the board? Okay. I put together a proposed, please don't take this as, you know, the gospel truth. This is just one person's opinion of how we should look at it. But I think there's three specific components we need to look at. Number one, we really need to define what judgment is. And what I propose to this committee right now is that judgment is a point where there is a choice between one or more alternatives, the selection of that choice constitutes judgment. When we do that, this policy, as it was written, says that that's an execution of practice that has to be sealed. And I'm not saying that jurisdiction doesn't have authority to make that call. All I'm saying is it's comply with the same laws as I do. You're going to say, this is the one and only interpretation. Please seal it, because there's liability that comes with that. If any of you had the chance to read the James Deutsch ruling on the Hyatt Regency collapse of 1981, you'll find that the first prong of liability he laid out was that if a person or an entity has the authority to stop progression of the project without their approval, that constitutes the first prong of liability. What we've got is jurisdictions who are saying, you want your permit, you've got to do this, but now they're escaping that liability by pinning it on me as the registrant, who may not necessarily agree with that point. So the first step is, let's define what that is. And that's why what I'm going through here saying in the first paragraph, that we just change it slightly to define what that judgment is. Oh, by the way, once it's executed, that judgment must be sealed immediately. Because one of the problems that we've got is the building officials say Section 104 out of the IBC, or the IFC has a 107 where it sits there and says you can appeal. Well, jurisdictions, especially right now during the last year with COVID, are looking for means to generate funds. This becomes a source of generating funds. Now, that's one of the reasons you'll see at the very bottom of my, if you will, suggestion is to say, hey, before you execute this, seal it. Because they could use this to one jurisdiction, $450 for an interpretation. And then all of a sudden they could sit there after the client pays that and says, you know what, we'll go ahead and give it away. Well, that's a hidden fee that my client should have to pay for just for me to exercise my authority and my judgment as the sealing registrant. So I brought this up because of all the problems I've had. I've had one in particular problem that really brought it down, where one jurisdiction a year ago accepted this particular standard of code interpretation on a project. A year later, I brought under the same conditions, same occupancy, same everything, the same thing, but because that same supervisor saw this project differently, said, no, we're not going to apply that lesser standard. And when I met with the building official and the team leader and everything to say, what about this other project? They said, we're not going to talk about the past project. Past project has nothing to do with it. What in essence they did is say, that project a year ago is less safe than today because we raised the standard. We haven't adopted the code, we haven't adopted an amendment, but now they're saying arbitrarily that because we accepted it there, which by the way, I agreed with that a year ago, today I want to do the same thing. They said, no way, our interpretation stands. You can do a code mod, you're not going to get it necessarily, but that's the way it works. And I have a problem with that because ultimately it is my seal, my judgment, and interpretation now. When a jurisdiction can sit there and say, we don't have to look at past practice, we don't have to look at past precedent, we don't have to look at the way the industry works today in interpreting, they're taking an awful lot of liberty under the guise of quote-unquote interpretation. So that's a little bit of the background that I've got. It was very hard to keep all this into two pages on a letter and do all this. There's my piece. I'll leave it up to the committee now to discuss. To suggest a motion to adopt my suggestion. Not that I'm being arrogant, but it doesn't sound like anyone's disagreeing.
Ed, you're muted.
Yes.
Oh, thank you. You think after a year and a half, almost 2 years, I'd get used to this. Over the last years, you know, since this was, this policy statement was adopted, I think back in 97 or something like that, I really haven't had any real issues. The code reviewers where I'm working all seem to adhere to it. They ask for something, give me a code citation. I guess I kind of look and go, oh, yeah, I missed something, or, okay, I hadn't quite looked at it that way, but I don't disagree, and I take care of it. So I haven't had an issue where I'm kind of crosswise with the with the reviewer based on their judgment of the code versus mine. Mr. Stanley, have you seen anything in your documents?
Very, very, very little. Nothing. Pretty much your same with yours. Just a little bit of a different twist on the code, or maybe they find some a little bit of a different, but I mean nothing of any substantial nature that we wouldn't just change it and go ahead.
And in fact, I had one recently where they wanted me to include construction safety details in my drawings in accordance with Section 3303 of the IBC, and I told them no. Because it's a liability exposure for the architect and the engineer, and he said, "Oh, okay."
If I may interject, I had a
Certainly.
Project with ASU that I was with where the plan reviewer did not accept that, and when we did put those drawings in, that was based off of their own city inspectors, it was rejected. I'm seeing up here in the valley. When I had my own firm that I had to close after the mortgage bubble burst in 2007, I had the last 3 years of my practice 57 projects issued on first permit reviews. I have now, even though I'm not practicing full-time anymore, my last three projects with one city here has went in for three reviews every time. And I'm a code specialist. Anyone who knows me knows I know the code as well, if not better, than most building officials. Hell, I've been teaching for ICC for years, and yet I'm having this problem regularly. I'm talking to others. I had a $40 million TI where the permit was held up for over 3.5 months because the plan reviewer didn't accept the architect's steel stud details for partitions, which aren't even regulated by the IBC, and yet the jurisdiction did nothing to speed it up. So there are areas. Now, granted, it may not be in the southern Arizona as much, but certainly up here in the valley, it's a big deal, and I really think we need to look at it because I've got right now where I am being told by a jurisdiction that in 712.91, there's this definition for what a two-story opening is, and one of the conditions to disqualify from it is the opening cannot be concealed within a wall. The plan reviewer stopped at concealed, and he exerted his authority over mine, saying, oh no, this elevator shaft that I've got is concealed because it doesn't meet this. And I said, it's not in a wall. I've got two walls. I even went back to the definitions, and the building official told me I was wrong. And I sat there and I said, you guys aren't reading the code. What you're doing is you're trying to tell me how to design. That's not your job. And I'm having this going on, and I've had it with many of the architects. I wouldn't have come here, but I've represented ASU in the public for the last 10 years of my career, first at the School Facilities Board, now at ASU. I'm seeing this being, you know, maybe in your individual practices, you don't see it as much, but because I work with multiple firms, multiple projects throughout a whole variety of stuff throughout the state, I'm seeing it becoming more and more of a problem where the jurisdictions are sitting there saying, we know better, and we're interpreting the code, even though they're executing judgment. And these are this same judgment definition I've been using on EACs for the better part of 10 years.
Thank you. Other comments? Dr. Angel.
Mr. Chair, so I understand the concern. I just don't know if this is anything that that a change in substantive policy will address. It seems like it's more, training with the code reviewers, coordination to work through it, and in the end, if, you know, it's a last resort, but if necessary, if someone feels like a reviewer is practicing or coercing a registrant into doing something, then you know, that maybe a case should be brought up for investigation. But I read the, forgive me if I'm missing something, but I read the policy already says what we're trying to get at. It says, in the second part, however, a non-registrant might not require modification of a professional document submitted for review unless that modification is supported by reference to an applicable code or standard. So it says, you know, if you're a reviewer, you can't, not only can you not modify, you cannot require a modification unless you point to specific code. Now, if there's a discrepancy in what the code says, I don't think that that's something that a substantive policy will address. That, I mean, ultimately, they're the ones who issue the building permit.
I'm not saying that they don't have the authority. What I'm saying is they need to execute the same authority we have. If they do, certainly, as a permitting agency, have the ability to require anything they want. However, if there is a judgment to be executed, because I'm going to tell you right now, I've had several EACs where there was a practice of, did someone seal drawings that wasn't theirs? And the judgment, we come back down to the same thing. If you're executing judgment, it constitutes practice of the profession. It has to be sealed. Why should I be compelled by another registrant or a non-registrant in a building area to say, you know what, we don't agree with the way you're seeing it. We're going to substitute our judgment for yours. Oh, by the way, have all the liability, because that's exactly what they're saying. I'm not saying they can't have that authority. What I'm saying is this substantive policy statement needs to be explicit enough to say, go ahead and do it, but then comply with it and seal it. Because right now, in this position where a city can sit there and say, you know what, we don't care. And by the way, at school facilities board, I heard it all the time. It's our money. We can tell them how to do it. You're right. You can. But you don't have the right to raise liability, or you don't have the right to displace the liability by making a professional judgment for a professional. And yet I've battled it at that agency. I see this very uniquely because my practice wasn't just in the private sector. I spent 33 and a half years there, but I spent the last 10 in the public sector. And I hear these discussions behind closed doors. Do you know that right now, and I just had a major meeting with Maricopa Department of Environmental Health Services right now, because their design guidelines for the kitchen has 90% of everything that they expect you to do in a commercial kitchen not required in the code that they cite. And on the cover it says, this is not the code, this is just the guidance document. So we've got an entire agency in Maricopa County not even looking at the code that they're supposed to enforce, but telling us your commercial kitchens will have all this stuff and we as registrants do it. But then when you go back to the code, we find out not one word of that's contained in the code. So is the solution for me to file a complaint against these people every time? And if it does, what happens when my next project goes to them? They're going to take retribution on it because they're gonna be pissed off because I've called them into question and I brought them before the board here. All I'm saying is let's update the policy to be a little more, because right now, just sitting there saying, we're not marking plans anymore and we're good, that doesn't change the compulsion figure. And that compulsion figure was the very base for the ruling that revoked license of Daniel Duncan and Jack Gillum in the Hyatt Regency, according to an appellate court rule. So this is a precedent setting out of the Hyatt Regency. So what I'm saying is we got to make our lives easier by letting the jurisdictions know they've got to be kept in check. It's not saying you can't do it. If you're going to do it, just comply with everyone else.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, can we get Kurt to scroll down to the substantive policy statement that this gentleman wants changed?
He's just sure. want to see the actual one.
It's page 38.
With his changes.
Yeah, it's page 38 of the document.
Either that or I can bring it up separately. It's just easier this way.
While folks are searching for that document, I kind of agree with Dr. Angel. I think if you struggle with the jurisdiction, complying with the substantive policy statement as it's written, I'm not sure that any changes, the proposed changes to the language, are going to offer any further encouragement to them than is already there. I think they're going to continue to ignore it. And the only recourse one would have, and I understand the whole retribution thing completely, I doubt that I would ever turn a code official into the tech board unless they were doing something really egregious, because of that fear.
But what happens if one of those decisions somewhere down the road comes back to liability on us? You know,
I can't speculate on that myself. Mr. Stanley?
I've done forensics investigations for the better part of 10 years, and I know it's hard to do that. That's one of the reasons why, after talking to all these jurisdictions for years, because the last 10 years I've had to go throughout the whole state, I picked up on key words that they've said, things that they say, well, we're complying with the current policy because... And I'm thinking just changing a few words in that policy takes that wind out of their sail, and all of a sudden now it brings them back to the table to talk to me instead of just saying, it's like that one plan reviewer out in Peoria. He was dead set, a retaining wall, the height of a retaining wall goes from top of foyer to top of wall, and it doesn't matter if that's 3 feet or 6 feet, and I'm only retaining 6 inches. He said it required full engineering because it was over 6 feet tall. And I'm sitting there saying, that's not the definition. And when I printed a copy out of from James Ambrose, Simplified Buildings Foundation, showing that it's only the height of the retained of the two surfaces, he sat there and said, I was wrong. He wasn't even an engineer or an architect. And he's like, who the hell are you to tell me I'm wrong? And yet, it cost my client money to get the engineering, money to build a wall that was over-designed, in my opinion, because instead of being a 2.5-foot retaining wall, it's now a 6-foot retaining wall because we dropped the footings down to natural grade instead of impact on the compactor stuff just because we didn't want to have settlement.
Dr. Angel.
Mr. Chairman, so first of all, I want to make sure I acknowledge Mr. Demlin's help on EACs and appreciate everything he does. I wanted to address two things. One is why I'm hesitant to change the policy as proposed. One is the fact that shifting the responsibility from the registrant to the building agency might end up in circumstances where maybe not Mr. Demlin, but another registrant will, you know, decline to do certain things in order to shift liability to the agency or to make them do their work when, in the end, for good or bad, I mean, their responsibility to get the plans approved and get things done is with the registrant. So I think it could backfire. And I do think, again, it might not say it exactly in the words that we want, but it does, the policy says, substitution of a registrant's professional judgment that result in a modification to the document constitutes the practice of the profession. So if somebody substitutes your professional judgment, they're practicing the profession. And then later on, when we talk about the second paragraph there, another registrant may, when employed to check the documents, this is the case we have, modify the documents. However, the registrant modifying said documents shall delineate all modifications, seal the changes, and be fully responsible. I think if somebody said, no, you need to make this change, and you disagree for matters of public safety, you shouldn't stamp it. And you can say, look, I won't stamp it, but if you want, you stamp it, and then under, or you know, you're asking me to do it, that's your judgment, your practice in the profession, you stamp it for this statement. So, I mean, you can have the conversation. Again, the policy or the statement is not going to change an agency's opinion just by being there, I don't think.
And I think, Dr. Angel, the problem with that is there's not a building official, even if they're a registrant, that's going to make changes on any document and seal it.
They're
not going to do that. So now you're in a log jam. You've got a set of documents that they are insisting on a change. You disagree with the change, and that's you're stuck. So I understand that point, but I don't see any of this proposed language change changing that atmosphere. Like I said, I haven't encountered too many jurisdictions. I do work all over the state. And in some other states, and I've never had anyone dig their heels in like that on a code interpretation.
I have, but it's very few and far between.
Yeah.
And to the point where, you know, unless it's going to be even if it's the absurd, like the retaining wall example you cite for 2'6", it shouldn't make a difference in the world to the guy. You could put a stack of bunch of rocks there and it would stand up. That's not a problem. But, you know, for him to dig his heels on something like that, it costs your owner money, and hopefully it's not a whole bunch that it's going to cost him. Or, you know, I don't want to play the game, but the other game is to raise up your footing, and then when you go out, and when it goes out into the field, you lower it down as a change, and don't bring it back through for a review. You know, I mean, you know, so you can play games other ways, but with it too, you know.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I understand where he's coming from, but I don't see how anything that in the policy statement or anything that the board can do other than going out and trying to do outreach to these different jurisdictions and trying to give classes, which I don't know if, you know, the board doesn't have the money and the jurisdictions probably wouldn't show up for them.
Yeah.
So,
Mr. Pondren.
I agree with what Mr. Stanley said. One of the things I remember when I was with Mojave County Public Works back when this policy statement came into effect was, you know, a lot of what fixed the problem was the client came in and spoke to the director, and then there was no longer a problem anymore. Instead of the engineer or the surveyor arguing back and forth with the code guy. And I know that, you know, then, of course, back in those days, this was still pretty new, but that cleaned up a lot of the issues that we had with having a few people that were actually paying the fees come in and speak to them. But I agree that I don't see anything in here that changes that. Like I said, if they're not listening, I agree, then changing more words than that is not going to make those people listen.
Any other comments from the committee?
Peter here. I just want to agree. I want to agree with the committee members that are saying that this wording is not going to change people's attitudes in the field. I do believe that the engineer, as much as I sympathize with him, is on his own when it comes to fighting these battles, and that this committee can't do anything for him.
What I'm hearing from the board, from the committee, unless I hear otherwise, is that we will not take any action on this agenda item as well.
That's correct. I agree.
All in agreement?
Yes.
I'm in agreement.
Great. Thank you, sir. We appreciate your time and bringing it before our committee.
I thank you for the time for considering it.
Sure. Good. Next agenda item, Mr. Winter.
Yes, sir.
So we're going on to 5C, and I do have individual bank price that we'd like to call for this.
Okay.
Give him a call.
Hello, phone. And,
Mr. Stanley, by the way, I'm kicking you on and off. I don't think your headphones are broken. So I can hear a lot of background on your end.
Mr. Stanley, can you mute?
Yep.
Sure. Can you mute? Yeah, I'm getting some background. There we go. How's that, Mr. Winter?
Yeah, he's muted now, but I think he has headphones on. I see in the image, and I just wonder if they're not plugged in because we're hearing the other audio in the background.
Yeah.
I know I muted him a number of times. I feel bad for doing it.
Yes, it is.
This is Kurt Winter at the Arizona Board of Technical Registration here at the LNR committee meeting. Are you available to talk, sir?
Yes, I am.
All right, very good. I'll give it back to the chair.
Okay, welcome to the Legislation and Rules Committee meeting. We are on agenda item 5C, which is that page. Bear with me, please. Too many screens to looking for the board's current policy on creation of GPS machine control models and whether or not Arizona has some policies similar to North Carolina that establish this work as engineering or survey work, thereby being subject to the state laws on engineering and surveying services. You'd like to make a statement to the committee, we would appreciate it at this time. And state your name for the record, please.
Sure. My name is Ben Chrysler. I'm an engineer licensed in Arizona. And that matter of fact, our company is here in Arizona, but we do work throughout the country, throughout the U.S. We've run into a number of situations. This is one of those emerging technologies, I suppose, where the equipment out in the field now, much more of it all the time, is being turned over to computers. For instance, inside of a grader, there'll be a guy sitting there, and that's about all he does, push the red button if something goes wrong. But what happens is there's a computer program that's loaded, or a file is loaded into his machine, and that file is what we develop. And we take it a set of engineers' plans, and then we go through it, and we essentially, for all intents and purposes, we actually build it on the computer. We go through and lay out the roads and everything, and we find the errors, and we make suggestions about how they can fix those. And then they convert that into the program to read, that can be read by the machine itself, and then that's fed into the machine. So that's what we do, and we do it all over the country and even in Canada. And we ran into this instance with North Carolina, particularly stated that this, the creation of design and design of control models, profiles, cross sections for the electronic data use in the digital terrain models for the purpose of earthwork grading and stakeout is within the definition of the practice of land surveying and engineering. And so we've kind of polled a lot of the states trying to find out where does everybody stand on this because it is a new technology.
Thank you. So just being a lowly architect and doesn't really understand all of the technology side of civil engineering and surveying, do you take the work of a registrant and download that into your system so that then it can be utilized to do, say, a grading for a parking lot or something like that? Is that?
Yes. So we could take a parking lot, for example, so the engineer would design that, and the plans that he would that he gives to the contractor, and that's usually who we get our work from, is the contractor, occasionally the engineer, but usually it's the contractor. He comes to us and says, look, I'm going to build this, but I need a machine control model to do it. And so we take those plans as well as the CAD file from the engineer, and we take those and essentially rebuild the whole thing, actually to construct it on the computer screen, and then find areas where there are problems. And we make recommendations about how to fix those. Because a lot of what they do now is they don't use surveyors anymore, except maybe to set up GPS control around the outside of the site. The machine itself, be it an excavator or grader or a front end loader or whatever, is then using our program to begin to move the earth wherever it needs to be moved or dig the trench.
So not unlike a CNC machine or a 3D printer or something like that, where we're taking someone's electronic data and transforming it and then using it to build something. Or
essentially that's what it is.
Okay.
There's two parts of this, and I suppose one of them is rather innocuous and wouldn't fall under any rules. You know, just making a conversion. You get the stuff and you convert it. May or may not. I mean, it depends on the other contractor, I guess, and what he's doing. And we had, there are a lot of what we call fly-by-nights out there, the guys that pull up on the site in their pickup truck and they just sit in the cab with a computer and they merely plug in what they're given, convert it, and hand it back, errors and all. And we kind of feel that that's a detriment to the public's health, safety, and welfare, because there are issues that need to be caught and fixed that maybe won't be caught and fixed any other way. So we've got those people doing it. But also, when we're doing this, and if you're doing it right, you're going to do it and you're going to go, hey, you've got a low spot in the middle of this parking lot. Matter of fact, it's a foot lower than everything around it. We recommend you raise it up to this elevation so it drains properly. Then, at that point, you're actually changing the work of another professional engineer.
This is Deanie. I would just like to ask a question. Are you actually changing the work, or are you requesting that they change their work?
Well, that could be a tough one. We change it in our model, and then we write a report. I believe I sent you a copy of a sample report that we send to them called the Machine Control Model Design Report, which I review and sign and seal. And in that, we tell them, look, at this point, we found this problem. We fixed it with this. Please review it with the design engineer.
But you're leaving the final decision up to the engineer?
Definitely.
Okay.
Because I know that that gets into the issue of when I make a change to some other engineer's plan, I required to assume responsibility for it. So we make a change in our model, we tell them about it, we tell them to review it because we want the engineer to sign off on it. Whether he does or not, we don't know.
Comments from the committee.
I believe Mike has his hand up.
Yes, Mike.
Well, I want to go back on a couple of things here. And A, this is not new technology. I was working with machine control back in the early 2000s. As soon as Trimble got all figured out how to put it onto their motor graders and their other equipment, we were there. And I've been involved in several projects over the years where, as a surveyor, we set control for them to work off of and establish. I've worked with many contractors that have their own people that develop their models and different things. I know over the course of many years here in Arizona, we've looked at the machine control issue before, never felt that there was, it essentially falls under the basically what the contractor's doing his own grade checking, and it's on him at that time. If he does something like that or builds a model like that, then, and doesn't have it checked, and at the end the as-built are out, that's strictly on him, not on the surveyor, not on the engineer. So it's never been an enforcement issue here that I'm aware of, and it's never, it was discussed, like I said, many years ago, but just not an issue, at least in Arizona and in other states. I work with the Western Federation of Professional Surveyors. I was the Arizona director on that, and over the, you know, I've been involved in that since around 2004, 2005, and every once in a while the conversation comes up with that. But most boards that I'm aware of don't really consider that portion of it surveying or engineering. It's just grade checking. We, you know, our statutes do say that we, for the placement of points on the ground for the purpose of new construction, is surveying or engineering. But a lot of times we'll go out and do that for them to set their control too. But as like I said, it's pretty common practice in a lot of instances. There was a big push for it years ago. I also know there was a lot of contractors that backed off of it because they realized that if their stuff wasn't right, that they were going to have to go back and move the dirt again. So it's kind of gone back and forth from what I'm aware of. But no, like I said, I've never been aware of any enforcement issues with that. Not from the board, maybe civil action or something if somebody sues somebody for too much dirt, but not here.
Yeah, and I don't mean to imply that this is absolutely new technology. It's what Arkansas called it, an emerging technology. It's changing, and big companies are doing it now, and it's slowly filtering down to smaller companies just because of the cost involved. But what you say is true. The problem comes in is because of the work we do. We're very thorough in our work. Like I say, we literally build this on the screen using the engineer's plans, and we find those errors to correct them so the contractor can rest assured when he gets our material that he can go out there and use it without error, that he's not going to end up having to go back and move dirt later. And that's where we feel the professionalism comes in, by having it done by licensed engineers and surveyors who know what they're seeing on the screen and what they're doing. We can prevent a lot of these problems. We actually end up saving the contractor money, because he doesn't have to go back and redo something. We save the owner money because he doesn't get a change order, and we actually can save the bacon of the engineer, because quite often we find errors that could have caused him some problems or her.
Dr. Angel.
Dr. Angel, do you mind if I jump in real quick? This is Kurt Winter. I just want to say, Mr. Fondren, I don't know why, but whenever you are not muted and someone's talking, it's doing an echo. So I'm just wondering if you have two devices on the same meeting or a phone and the computer, so just be aware of that, and that's why I keep muting you.
Negative, just one computer. I don't know.
Mr. Chair, I was going to agree with Mr. Fondren that I think you know, this isn't really the practice of surveying, but I did want to maybe ask how this typically happens. So the normal process without the machine would be for a survey crew to go out there and stake, you know, the elevations, and neither the party chief, not the Rotman, or, you know, land surveyors, registered land surveyors, often, sometimes they are. So that part is fine. And whether it's a machine that's directing where it goes or whether it's the stake put by a survey crew, to me that's not that different. So I don't see the surveying. I think the part that I don't know, and I'd like to get Mr. Fondren's input, is the big issue I see, for instance, is somebody missing the datum or the coordinate system and ended up where it's not. So that's where typically having RLS in the office loading the points before they go out there make the difference. So with the machine system, is it the same way? Should it be the same way, where somebody figures out they're on the right coordinate system and datum before they go out, or is there no involvement at all from a land surveyor with the machine systems?
typically when we're dealing with it, there is, the company has a land surveyor involved because we've gotten responses back that, hey, your model doesn't match our control of what's going on here. And so we work with them to find out, well, where's the problem at? So somebody on their end is loading, is trying to load this and make it work. And we get calls occasionally from the surveyor because we do use the surveyor's control if they provide it to make sure that we're rotated and translated correctly to the location of the project.
Because what I see is if somebody put the stakes in the wrong place, it would fall back on the surveyor who calculated things. If a machine puts the points in the wrong spot or grades incorrectly, somebody should take responsibility for where that went, and I don't know who that is. Mr. Pondren?
Mr. Pondren. And then Mr. Stanley.
So the process is really quite simple, sir. When we do this type of activity, we'll go out, and we probably already set the control. If I was the mapping surveyor, I've got other control. We work with the contractor to establish a base point for him, proper datum, everything is resolved there. The issue that I think the other gentleman's referring to is the design itself. And I agree with him. I mean, I realize they're putting forth an extra effort to try to make sure that it's correct. And in the old days, that's what the surveyor's job was. If the engineering plans didn't quite match what was on the ground, then that was our responsibility to bring that to the attention of the contractor. But that I agree, they don't use us very much for that activity anymore either. And in some instances, we'll go out and set additional control too for them to check into on a regular basis and different things. So, as far as the model's concerned, no, I mean, the surveyor wouldn't have anything to mess with that either, but we do make sure that the contractor has established the correct datum, and if they have not hired us or an engineer to do that, then, again, that's fully on them to take the responsibility for that.
I just want to make sure I understand correctly. So, yeah, if the design is incorrect, right, if we check it, if by rain we check it, great. But if they don't, that's the engineer, the designer's fault if it's incorrect. So on one end is on the design engineer. During construction, the responsibility for having the right datum and coordinate system is on a surveyor. But once they get past that point, it's entirely on the contractor to deal with it however they see fit. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir. I mean, once we hand it off to them, if they don't want us to come back in and check it, then it's completely on them, so.
Okay.
Mr. Stanley.
I don't see where this is any different than, for instance, a steel fabricator that takes the engineers and the architect's drawings, produces a 3D image of the building, complete with every nut and bolt in there, and then occasionally finds a dimensional bust or a conflict or something like that and brings it to everybody's attention. To me, it's the same thing, and I don't think, and they're not, they don't require a seal, and I don't necessarily see where we would require a seal for this.
I tend to agree. Mr. Leeds.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, Mr. Kreisler, your concern is that, and I noticed in your paperwork with Ranger Engineering that you actually are certified PEs, and that the work that you do is done under the supervision of a PE, and that your concern is that other people are doing it without the PE certification, and North Carolina, I believe it was, is requiring your type of work to be supervised at least by a PE. Your concern is other people doing jobs that without the professional engineer. To me, it seems that you're in the catbird seat as far as your advertising goes. That you can actually say that you're designing all these under the guidance of the PE, and everyone else is not. I don't see that the State Board of Technical Registration needs to say that. I think that maybe, once again, we're in a forum where we're probably not going to make any changes. Peter out.
Thank you, Mr. Leeds. Any other comments?
I tend to agree. I think Ranger has a good value-added proposition by having an engineer, but I don't see it as a requirement. So
before coming to the, this is Leroy Brady. Before coming to the meeting, I did a little bit of checking within ADOT, and within ADOT, we require either a PE or if it's land surveying, that they be registered as a land surveyor for any of this kind of work.
Does that include the design of the program?
The design of the program is done by under the direction of a registrant, because we are a public works agency.
And I think Mr. Brady, the construction also needs to be overseen by a registrant.
That's right. That is
because
correct.
It's public works.
Correct.
But I do think that's because it's public works that you need to oversee it, and I don't see it as a requirement under a statute that, you know, that the grading be done by a registrant. The way it happens on ADOT projects is, again, a surveyor calculates everything, a crew goes and stakes it, and then there's another crew that comes back and checks it later. And make sure that it meets design.
How much of that is done under a registrant, though? That somewhere in that path there's a registrant overseeing things.
The crew that comes back and checks it for QC reports to the RE, and the RE is the one that accepts or rejects.
Other questions, comments?
Mr. Chairman, Peter, just for clarification, we were just told that in public works they are using PEs for even the design of these programs, and building or doing the grading, but it's not required for private work. Is that true? Is that what I heard?
I didn't say anything about private work. I only addressed it from a public work standpoint and ADOT.
Mr. Fondren.
In the ADOT construction projects that I've done, and granted I haven't done one in about 10, 15 years, thank goodness, but the surveyors laid the control, the engineering created the DTM originally, I mean, because that's really what this is all based off of. What's loaded up in that, then that DTM is loaded up into the machine. And then, yeah, at some point, the surveyors come back and grade check the thing or as built the thing, and then the engineer signs off on it. As far as your statement of building the program, I don't even believe that's correct with ADOT, unless that's a new change thing. But all the data going up into the program, because the program is a vendor-created item, whether it's Trimble or Topcon or whoever, and that has to have a certain parameter set in it to be loaded up. But as far as like the pre and the post, and even sometimes during, is all checked by a registrant of some kind, surveyor or engineer. But to be clear, I will add for private, it's a crapshoot.
Even on the private side, we sometimes question that, because what private project doesn't involve affecting some public work somehow, be it a sewer, a connection to a sewer line, a water line, that sort of thing. So we always figure that in private work, it may be on private property or private development, but it involves some public works of some sort, because it may be a subdivision with public streets being built.
But to be clear, the reason we're making a difference is because Arizona has a specific statute for public works, that public works projects have to be overseen. The construction has to be overseen by a professional registrant. We don't have that requirement for a private project, that still doesn't mean you still need a design that's sealed by an engineer, and then you still need a surveyor to set the control on the back end for construction. But once that's done, it's the contractor's responsibility to do it right and liability if they don't.
Mm-hmm. One more question for Mr. Kreisler.
Yes.
Ben, if in fact you do make changes, say you do have that 2-foot drop in the middle of the parking lot, and you recommend changes, and the changes are made, do you take responsibility for those changes, or does the PE of the origin take responsibility?
That is a question that I wonder what's going to happen someday if somebody brings that up. I don't know how it's going to end up, because we're making our model look correctly, and yes, we are inadvertently changing the engineer's design, but we're also telling the client, who is usually a contractor, to please review that with the engineer, because we want him to take responsibility for it. And we do get responses from sometimes. The engineers do respond and say, yes, you're right, thank you, we'll use that. And so we do get their approval on it. Lots of times we don't, though. The contractor just goes ahead and builds it.
Thank you.
I'd be cautious, because I think if you make the change and nobody signs off on it, you own it. So I mean, just as a business practice, this is not board regulation. You might want to check back with the contractor to make sure somebody buys off on it. Otherwise, you're doing what the previous policy said not to do, which is alter professional documents.
Well, my understanding on the previous policy is that as a professional engineer, I can alter them, but I've got to take responsibility for the alteration they make.
Right. That's my point. If you alter it, you own it, unless you check back with them.
So. Yeah. And that's the part where we're saying, does an engineer need to be involved when the guy in the pickup just pulls up there and he quickly makes a conversion? He goes, oh, by the way, this is low, I raised it up for you.
I think you both need to follow the same process and get the design engineer to buy off on it.
Uh-huh.
And ultimately, if nobody raises a red flag and there's something wrong, the design engineer is going to be responsible for it, not the contractor. I guarantee you the contractor will get paid again to regrade it, and the engineer will eat the liability if they get it wrong, or the agency.
But again, that's where it begins to, you go, is that protecting the public's health, safety, and welfare? I mean, I don't know. That's why we're asking for this.
Well, we do recognize that the engineers and the contractors, that everyone involved is part of the public and should be protected with public safety. On the other hand, I think Mr. Angel made it clear that who's responsible for what phase all the way through the process that you're doing, with the surveyors to mark the points, with the engineer to set the levels, I mean, and the contractor to follow the rules, follow the plan. So I don't see that it's really an issue or a problem that we need to address at this point.
Great.
Any other comments from the committee? Hearing none, another item that we'll take no action on.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I just want to thank you all for your time. I appreciate it. Like I said, we've been polling a number of states trying to find out where they stand, particularly after hearing from North Carolina that we had to be licensed there, which I'm licensed there, so that took care of that. But we thank you for your time, so we're just trying to see where everybody stands on it.
Okay. Well, thank you, and appreciate you bringing it to our attention.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
All right. The next agenda item, 5D, discuss public concern that the services of cottagemaps.com offers maybe practice of land surveying. Has anyone looked at their website?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I went to the website and it's no longer there.
Yeah, it's there, but it says, we've been dealing with a variety of complaints from surveyor groups across Canada, not the United States, who really don't love us. Due to ongoing discussions around these complaints, we're suspending our service offering until we're able to reach an agreement that satisfies the surveyor groups and protects our business operations going forward.
Well, without being able to see the site and what they actually offer, I don't know if we can do anything on this item either.
I don't think we can until their site comes back and we see what they're doing.
And this is Kurt Winter.
Yes, Mr. Fondren.
To the individual who had first submitted this, and he didn't reply back to me about it, so maybe because the site went down, he didn't see there's a problem, but I can only surmise why he get back to me.
Mr. Fondren.
Yeah, well, I was reading Mr. Praylin's comments that he had gone back and looked at some older cases, so I'm assuming that they were showing boundaries overlaid, because that's what Mr. Praylin is pointing out in the comments in here. And I know just recently, within the last year and a half or so, we went through this with the drone company that was doing the same kind of thing, and they just have to be real careful as far as, you know, showing an overlaid boundary on one thing on a picture is one thing, in my opinion, and depicting that boundary as regulatory on a drawing is completely different. And there's a fine line there with a lot of that. Real estate companies have been doing, I mean, I've seen that stuff for years. I try not to get too worked up about it. They're not, it's kind of like the people that call and want to know how come the assessor's data doesn't quite look like it should be, you know, I mean, it's just one of those things. I, you know, picking your battles is important, I think, with some of these items, with this technology items especially.
Yeah.
So, chances are it may look kind of bad, but I question is the, but it, like Mr. Lee said, dude, it's down, so we really can't see what they were doing. So, and it's been down since I think that link came out, released us, because I checked it the first day and it was down, so. Mm-hmm.
And Mr. Chair, when you were on the board, we dealt with a case like this.
Yes, we did.
When they were showing boundaries on aerial photos as well, without any, you know, actual field work to check it. So I think where we landed back in the day was, you know, it needed to have a clear disclaimer to the public as to what it could be used for and what it wasn't, so that, you know, you wouldn't get a title report off of it or something like that. But you're right. We don't know what they're doing. I just think, this is going to keep coming up. So
yep, I think it will. I think we'll see it more and more. You know, but I mean, even if you go to like a county GIS website, you can pull up property boundaries there in quotes. You know, they're not at all accurate, but.
Yeah, if it says, you know, this data is approximate and is for the purpose of visualization, that's fine. Yeah. But it's approximate. But if you're trying to figure out if a tree is in your property or a wall, that's not how you should do it.
Yeah, you can't do it that way.
You better get surveyed. Yep.
Yep.
When I remind people when I deal with this over the phone is that those parcel boundaries are there for you to get a tax bill.
Yes.
That's all they're concerned about, really. That's why they have that big disclaimer on there. Yes. Their square footages will match record, but as far as where that lands on the map, that's up for grabs.
Yeah. Yep. Exactly. So no action on this one either. Agenda item 6, future agenda items.
I guess we'll wait and see.
Yeah. We made it less than a year between meetings.
Not bad.
Barely. So future meeting, I think we kind of serve at the will of the board. So.
Yeah, once again.
Whenever they want us, they'll call us. Kurt will call us.
Yeah.
Yes, he does.
I appreciate the opportunity to help you guys out.
Well, thank you. Thanks, everyone on the committee. I really appreciate it. Alejandro, you won't have a whole lot to report back to the board.
Just as well.
Well, Mr. Chairman, then I'll make a motion to adjourn.
I have a motion. Do I have a second?
I'll second
that. I'll second.
Leroy seconds. All those in favor?
Aye.
And thank you all.
All right. Yes. Yes, Leroy.
I would just like to point out how amazingly better engineers look on remote meetings.
Leroy, I am so glad to see that you haven't lost your love for engineers.
Yeah, some things never change.
Goodbye, Jeff.
Bye, everyone.
Take care.
Thank you very much. See you all later.
Bye.
Good.
You got that little jab in there.